Hi, and welcome to Traditional Medicine Podcast. I am your host, Cara Lovick. In today's episode, we're going to be talking to you mental health experts. Yes, you. Are you offering integration services to clients who have received plant medicine like ayahuasca or have done any other kind of traditional indigenous healing of any sort? Are you offering preparational support for clients that are about to do plant medicine like ayahuasca or doing any other kind of traditional indigenous healing? If this is you, then bring the coffee, bring the tea, and step into my office because you and I need to have a chat. If this is the first time that you're tuning into this podcast, here's what you can expect to hear. We talk all things Amazonian and high Andean healing traditions of Peru. I've been volunteering for a variety of healers for over 9 years, but for more than half of that time, I have really spent my time volunteering for Amazonian and high Andean healers of Peru. In this podcast, really the aim is to build a bridge between traditional indigenous healers and modern society. I am here to distill all that experience, all that information, so that you can feel closer to these traditions. Also, I work on a very special project with the Kiro community to help connect their world-renowned healers with the people who need them. So if you want to check out that very special project, go ahead and check out traditionalmedicinemiami.com. Or if you're on Instagram, go ahead and follow us. We are Traditional Medicine Miami, and send us a message. We'd be happy to connect with you. So let's get started talking about today's episode. I wanted to give you a heads up in terms of what you can expect from today's episode. We're going to be mainly establishing common ground between mental health experts and traditional indigenous healers. It just so happens to be that our common ground are our common challenges in terms of what is coming in the way of us helping people recover, heal, et cetera, et cetera. So we're going to talk about the challenges that we have together. We also want to then springboard from the challenges to opportunities. So don't get too bummed out. We are going to get to the opportunities. And if not entirely in this episode, it will be part two in episode 17. So don't worry, we'll get there. It's really important that we talk about these challenges first, though. So hang in there. So with that said, let's get into the bad news, which is going to help set the stage for today's episode. I want to start off by reading a research paper published by JAMA Psychiatry, J-A-M-A. And the title of this research paper is Association of Suicide Prevention Interventions with Subsequent Suicide Attempts, Linkage to Follow-Up Care, and Depression Symptoms for Acute Care Settings, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. Now, the first sentence says, suicide rates have been rising for 2 decades in the United States. So why is mental health declining in the United States? Well, two epidemiologists from the UK by the name of Kate Pickett and Richard Wilkinson began to ask that same question. And it wasn't only about the US, but other rich market democracies. They wanted to know if there was any factor that could help determine whether a large society was going to do well or was going to do poor on social and health outcomes. Now, epidemiologists are health experts who study very large populations, and they gather data to try to determine if there are any patterns or if there are any factors that are creating positive or negative results for human populations. Now, when these two epidemiologists went out to basically answer this question, like what made healthy human populations, at first they thought, well, it's got to be the gross national income per capita, right? So the dollar value of a country's final income in a year divided by its population. It seemed reasonable to believe that the more money a country had, the better off that they would probably do on social and health outcomes. So they organized health and social data pertaining to physical health, mental health, drug abuse, education, imprisonment, obesity, social mobility, trust in community life, violence, teenage pregnancies, and child well-being. And what they found was that there was no correlation. So even though the gross national income was higher, there was no pattern, right? There were some that had less gross national income, and they were doing better in some of these things. So there was no correlation between that. So more did not mean better. in the case of these rich market democracies. So then they're like, okay, well, let's try again. How about we organize the data based on income inequality? And lo and behold, there was a pattern. The more income inequality that these rich countries had, the worse off that they did on practically every social and health outcome that they were measuring. And what their research really found, without changing anything, just by organizing this data in terms of income inequality, it showed conclusively that less equal societies fared worse than more equal ones across everything from education to life expectancy. And so they put out a book called The Spirit Level, Why More Equal Societies Almost Always Do Better, and published that in 2009, right? And really kind of showcased the effects that income inequality has on societies, eroding trust, increasing anxiety and illness, and encouraging excessive consumption. And it showed that for each of the 11 different health and social problems, the ones I had mentioned, physical health, mental health, drug abuse, education, imprisonment, obesity, social mobility, trust in community life, violence, teenage pregnancies, and child well-being, the outcomes are significantly worse in more unequal communities and countries. They also published a book called The Inner Level, and that goes on to explain how income inequality affects us individually, how it alters how we think, feel, and behave. And it really set out that overwhelming evidence that material inequalities have powerful psychological effects when the gap between rich and poor increases. So why does income inequality affect human populations in this way? Well, anthropologists and other professionals who have studied the evolutionary history of our species have an idea as to why. It really all boils down to the fact that as a species, we have been developing in a very different social environment than the one that we are currently in today. For hundreds of thousands of years, if not millions, we have been evolving in a social environment called the hunter-gatherer band. And this particular social environment has characteristics that could not be further away from the current social environment that we find ourselves in today. Some examples of the characteristics of the social environment that we spent most of the time developing in physiologically, psychologically, emotionally, intellectually, physically, were meat sharing. So if you had a mouth, you were going to get fed, whether or not you were part of that hunting activity or gathering activity. They were sharing resources with everyone indiscriminately. We had situational leadership. That meant that it really depended on the challenge that that group was facing and the skills that was found within that group. So there wasn't just one person leading all the time. Everybody was making decisions together, and they were allowing different people to have leadership roles depending on what was required at the time. There were also counter-dominance responses in the group. So that meant that if someone fell and bumped their head and woke up thinking, oh, I am better than everybody else, I should get extra berries or whatever it was, the group would quickly handle that. They would either ignore the person, not feed them, or worst case scenario, they would really kill this person off or run them away from that group. So you were never going to find somebody sitting on top of a hill of blackberries. Meanwhile, the people in the group had none or very little at all. It just wasn't going to happen. And now we have that occurring all the time. You have people that have, you know, 10 houses and more than they and their family can spend in a lifetime. And in the same area, you have people that are homeless. You have people that don't have food, that don't have education. And it's just not healthy for us. It's just not. It's actually not healthy for neither the rich nor the poor, because the rich are also being affected. Everybody is affected by each other. It's, you know, COVID kind of showed us what that's about. But this is also the case. So people that are rich and live in countries with large inequality, they are also experiencing the brunt of mental illness, health problems, and the entire slew of negative social and health outcomes as well. So it's not like they are being saved either. It's not good for anybody. And like I mentioned, we just haven't been around in this new environment, this new social environment for long enough to adapt. Because to adapt and change, it takes hundreds of thousands of years. It takes a long, long time. You're not going to be able to radically adapt yourself, your bodies, right, as a species in less than 10,000 years. That is just not realistic. It takes a long time for evolution to take place. So we are definitely going to experience negative effects of being in such a drastically different social environment. This new social environment really came about by advances in agriculture and farming, and that has only been maybe 2,000 years ago, maybe even 5,000 years ago, but it doesn't hold a candle to the amount of time we spent in the hunter-gatherer social environment. So why am I bringing this up? Because it's important to understand that we are facing a lot of challenges, and they really do start with the way that we are socially engineering our societies. Our societies are not being created to produce healthier humans. In fact, they have somehow been engineered to do the exact opposite. And it doesn't look like we are going to be changing that anytime soon, unfortunately. And that is something that we need to come to terms with. It is something that will be a big challenge moving forward in terms of helping people with their mental health and health in general. Now, I want to continue reading from this article, and it says, in response to this crisis, and we're talking about the suicide rates that have been rising for two decades in the United States, in response to this crisis, the National Action Alliance for Suicide Prevention has called for healthcare organizations to incorporate suicide prevention into routine practice. Healthcare organizations are well positioned to prevent suicide deaths because more than one third of people who die by suicide have a healthcare encounter in the week before their death, and half within a month before their death. So one third of the people who are dying because of suicide, they are seeing someone a week before their death, and then half of them have seen someone a month before their death. I think that if you look at those numbers, it is understandable to feel a little uncomfortable with them because they're not necessarily passing grades. It's not necessarily something that we should be happy with. So there's good news. And now here's the good news about this entire thing. Yes, we're in a society that is socially engineered to produce negative social and health outcomes for the most part. We've normalized inequality. We've normalized abusive dynamics. We get that. And we see that we are having problems in helping people in crisis. This also we understand. Here's the good news. Traditional indigenous healers are doing some fantastic work, and in 1 to 4 sessions are doing things that that conventional medicine has not been able to do for these people. Now, you have to understand that traditional indigenous healers have been refining their discipline for thousands of years. Psychology has only been around for 200 years in terms of being a discipline. The good news is, and the opportunity that we have here, is that that psychology is incredible in terms of helping people reflect on their lives, in terms of helping them modify behaviors, in terms of giving them the kind of resources that they need to create some changes in their everyday conscious life. The good thing about traditional indigenous healers is that they look beyond that. They look where psychology cannot look, which is in the energetics. They look far beyond and below the surface. But together, they can really complement each other. Now, if you look on MAPS.org or Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, you see that there is a directory of different kinds of health experts, mental health experts that are trying to provide their own assistance in terms of the work that traditional indigenous healers have been doing, particularly with ayahuasca, but other types of traditional indigenous medicines too. Now I'm on this page and I would like to just kind of read to you a paragraph that they have put at the top of this particular directory page. Millions of people have had a psychedelic experience at some point in their lives without support. It can be challenging to understand and integrate these experiences. The psychedelic integration list is a resource of individuals and organizations in the mental health field who help people integrate past psychedelic experiences. Now, a lot of people have now begun to provide integrative kind of support or integration support and even preparational coaching or support prior to their clients' plant medicine healing, or as they describe it, a psychedelic experience. But very few of these therapists are having a conversation with traditional indigenous healers. And that is where we begin to go wrong. When we are not working together, having a conversation to make sure that we are providing people with some continuity in terms of the support that they are getting between both disciplines. Now, I want you to take a step back and just picture it, okay? Let's swap places here and you go into the shoes of the traditional indigenous healer and their discipline, and then they're going to go into your shoes. Ready? Okay, let's think about this. Can you imagine if it was you instead that was bringing about these kind of results in like less than four sessions, and somehow traditional indigenous healers decided, you know what, we know how to help people prepare for these really groundbreaking sessions with you, therapist. But they weren't consulting with you about how to best help you. And instead, they were just kind of like applying things however they thought was a good idea. Don't you think that would rub you the wrong way? Because if I were working with traditional indigenous healers and they started to do this, I would say there is something terribly wrong. This is not right. Why aren't we having a conversation with the people that are creating breakthroughs for clients? And why are we assuming that we know what that process should look like? That's not our discipline, right? That's kind of sort of the same way that we should be looking at it. But somehow I see that people are not seeing it this way. And it's not only really weird, but it's also not helpful to the clients. And it's also not helpful to anybody, even these therapists that are offering these services, because they're really shortchanging themselves on an incredible opportunity to be able to really provide the integration work, the support work to a whole new level that they cannot see because they're only seeing it from their discipline. And it is very limited on exactly what is happening, right? We need to collaborate with the other discipline because they are not seeing it the way that you're seeing it. It is very different for them. There's a reason why I really like Carl Jung and believe that the work that he started could help us bridge the gap between these two disciplines. It's not because he was necessarily right about everything he said, but he had enough objectivity to be able to build the kind of framework we needed to begin to have this conversation. For example, he himself had a reoccurring dream since childhood about a very important event that would take place in his life years in the future. He also observed other people having premonitions in their dreams about their own deaths, or having access to symbols that they had no idea of. Now, Carl Jung did make his assumptions in terms of why this was the case, and that is where he failed. That is where he just kind of took a guess. We don't have to guess because we do have the information to be able to make a better call about why we are experiencing this stuff. In Carl Jung's guesswork, you'll see that traditional indigenous communities are constantly invoked in his ideas. If we had a dollar for every time Carl Jung brought up primitive people, so-called primitive people, then, you know, this entire world would be, you know, filthy rich. And he really made a mistake there because he really didn't know what he was talking about in terms of what was going on with traditional indigenous communities. He generalized. He didn't understand that there were different pockets of the community that had mastered certain traditions, had mastered different disciplines and that they were not all the same. That was a terrible mistake that he made. But really the biggest mistake he made was thinking that he knew what was going on when he never humbled himself enough to even walk down these paths, to even begin to be initiated, to even begin to learn from these masters. And because he did that, he missed an opportunity to take his work to new heights. And we don't have to make the same mistakes that Carl Jung made. We could actually do what he couldn't do, which was collaborate and build a bridge between both disciplines so that we could benefit from the assets that these communities have gathered in the thousands of years that their disciplines have been in the process of refinement. So this episode is going a little longer than I was hoping it'd go. What we're going to do is we're going to do a part two, but I'm going to tell you a little bit about what we're going to talk about in this part two. What mental health experts are missing from their integration support that they are offering clients who have done plant medicines like ayahuasca or other traditional indigenous healing, they're missing energetics, right? There's a lot of things happening which you cannot see. And it's important that you see it in order for you to be able to say that you're truly helping out in this process. Because if you don't understand this aspect of it, then you can't truly say you are supporting it. Okay. It's so important because it is energetics most of the time when we are dealing with traditional indigenous healing. And also you need to understand this aspect of it when you're offering preparational work and support for clients who are preparing to do plant medicine. You cannot say that you can properly support them if you don't understand what traditional indigenous healers understand of this process. Energetics begin as soon as the client pays for the services and continues to go on even after they come back from the retreat or even after they have received these healing services. And you cannot be in the dark about it. It's important that you collaborate with them, or at least it's important that you know what is happening. So I am going to go over that in the next episode, which will be episode 17, I promise. And we're going to get into also how important your role is if we can work together, right? And I just want to make sure that what you're offering is also still fitting into the framework of what these traditional indigenous disciplines are really all about, because you are trying to fit into these services that are being provided by traditional indigenous healers. And it's only right that you understand what exactly is happening. You have to know what's happening if you really want to help out in this process. So let's go over today's episode. We did talk about the problems and the challenges that we're facing. And epidemiologists and anthropologists and different types of health experts have come together to say two things. Hey, we're not really engineering, socially engineering a society that's producing healthier people, and this is why. Right. So we went over that problem. We also went over the problem that we're having in terms of how biomedicine is dealing with some serious issues in our community. Suicide rates have been rising for two decades in the United States, and we haven't really been able to figure out what to do about it in a way that really kind of lets us feel okay about this. We have people going to traditional indigenous healers in the Amazon and the high Andes, which is fantastic. But at the same time, we don't have the kind of continuity in terms of support that we should between both disciplines. There's a lot of people offering these integration services and preparation support, but they rarely ever, if ever, talk to traditional indigenous healers about how they can properly help. So people are really coming up with their own solutions without really having a conversation with them. And this is not right. This is not a good idea because we are missing a really big part of it. And like I said before, next episode, we're going to go over the good news, the ways that we can collaborate, and how you can offer these services without being in conflict with the framework in which traditional Indigenous healers are working with. So there is a way to fit everything in. Everybody can have a part in the healing. We need both disciplines, but it's important that that you understand things from their perspective so that you could actually really maximize the efforts that need to happen in order to provide some continuity in the support that is going on here for the client. So thank you so much for tuning into today's episode. Hey, if you're on Instagram, go ahead and follow us. We're Traditional Medicine Miami, and we'd love to connect with you. Also, if you want to check out our website, go ahead to traditionalmedicinemiami.com. You can learn a little bit about what we do and the project that we have going on with the Kiro community, as well as the Amazonian community of Peru. As always, have a great night or day. I hope you're having a wonderful time wherever you are. And I hope to see you again next time. Bye-bye.